Hey, Unorthodox listeners, we've tried to clean out our potty mouths for the new year to get a nice clean, lemony-scented start. But just in case there are still obscenities escaping from our lips, why don't you wait to listen to this podcast until a time when the kinder, the children, are out of the room, and then turn it up to 11. Noah, the HelloFresh is the first ad this week.
Hi, Noah.
Hi, Noah. Noah, what are you wearing? Is it plaid?
Take it off.
I leave obscene messages for Noah.
I'm sorry. He might be warm.
Hello, Jews of 2017. This is Unorthodox, the weekly podcast from Tablet Magazine. I'm Mark Oppenheimer, joined as ever by Tablet senior writer Liel Leibowitz.
Season's greetings.
Season's greetings. And Tablet deputy editor Stephanie Butnick.
Merry 2017.
Our Jew of the week is comedian Lynn Harris, who will talk about her new startup to empower the future of females in comedy. And our Gentile of the week is science writer and neo-Buddhist and son of a Southern Baptist, Robert Wright, who is always good fun. So it's a great show today.
The only man who could ever reach me. Was a son of a Southern Baptist.
Son of a Southern Baptist preacher man.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, good to be back in the studio. It's been 3 weeks.
Wow.
Has it been that long?
It's been
like... feels like years.
It feels like years. What's up,
Jews? Feels like a year has passed.
What is up, Jews? I will lead off. Hanukkah at our house this year was peaceful. There were no fights about, like, my sister got bigger, nicer barrettes than I did. There was no, like, her jelly beans are more bursting with flavor than my jelly beans. There was actual...
Their gifts are barrettes and jelly beans?
I like that.
Well, so one night, I'll tell you. So one night...
It's really Little House of the Prairie.
One night, my in-laws always give all four of them matching pajamas. There's pajama night for my in-laws. There's one night when my parents usually give them all something. It's like one set of grandparents, another set of grandparents, barrettes, books... something and something.
They all have to start with B.
Yeah. So it's sort of a serial thing. Like, you know, they get little things every night. The biggest of them, the most expensive, are probably the pajamas. We try to keep it minimal. My friend Steve was saying how his parents and his in-laws each send 8 presents for each of his 2 kids.
That's us.
Every night,
that was us.
There's a grandma and grandpa present and another grandpa and grandpa present.
So you actually are off the hook, like, then, as the parent.
So he said they don't have to buy presents at all. On the other hand, they have 16 presents, like, before Bereshit. Like, it's, like, before the beginning of the world, each set of grandparents has sent presents. That's insane.
I fucking own Playmobil now. Like, you know Playmobil? I own
you
that
own
shit.
It.
Yep.
The whole thing.
The whole thing.
Wow. What was up with you guys?
Well, I have some news.
Yeah?
I guess it's on the Butnick front. My sister is pregnant. My older sister, Francesca, excited. I got clearance to share it on the air.
Boy?
It's a boy. A little baby Silverman, which is her last name.
And of course, we get to name the child.
So here's the thing. So my sister and Cliff met in Israel.
Her husband's name is Cliff?
Yeah, Cliff Silverman.
He's under 50?
Yeah, he is.
There's
the best.
Cliff.
Turns out they're both from Long Island, which shows you have to go to Israel to meet a nice Jewish boy from Long Island. But so I think they wanted, I mean... My idea is that for them is that they do like an Israeli name to honor, you know, like
Israeli names. I mean, Israeli names. I have to tell you, this will never not be funny to me. They're amazing. You have a Dudi, a Dudu, a Nimrod, and a Moron, and these are all completely socially acceptable.
Wait,
Moron?
Moron?
Well, it's Moron, but Moron, you know, pronounced like a normal person. It's a Moron. Moron. Why are you here? Moron, tell your brother Dudu and your other brother Nimrod and your brother Dudu to come here.
Now, Nimrod's a real biblical name. Dudu and Dudi and Moron are nicknames,
what's the difference?
Right?
Dudi.
What's the difference like between Dudu and Dudi? Like, what do they come from different
Dudu
names?
Dudu is a little bit more hardcore. You don't fuck with a Dudu.
Isn't there Dudi like a singer,
is a little bit,
Dudu?
Oh, there are a lot of Dudis too.
Most
can be spilled with them.
Did you give the language warning at the beginning of the show? So I want people to write in with good names.
Although even funnier, she could do the thing that most Israeli politicians do and come up with some like ridiculous nickname.
Okay,
like,
the nicknames
like,
are good.
Like Bougie.
Bougie.
Could the baby be Bougie Silverman?
I like that.
Because that is a hardcore name.
Wow, Bougie.
This one is for our listeners. Write to us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com. Subject line.
Baby Silverman.
Baby Silverman.
Stephanie, have you seen any great movies lately?
I saw Casablanca over the break for a friend's birthday.
How is it good?
No, Mark, do you like Casablanca?
I've never seen Casablanca. The backstory here on Orthodoxans is that right before we went on the air, I was saying I've never seen Casablanca because I don't watch black and white movies.
Because I was so embarrassed that I had never seen Casablanca. And then to my great relief, Mark actually doesn't watch the black and white canon.
I'm confident enough in my own cultural elite status that I don't have to go back and watch movies that are boring.
You just do Blu-ray.
So the man who hates museums. The man who shuns orchestras.
I don't shun orchestras. I don't shun orchestras.
Of course he loves orchestras.
I love orchestras. I just don't like museums.
But seriously, like, you never stop and wonder, like, huh, that Hitchcock guy all the cool kids are talking about, maybe he has something.
Hitchcock's movies, most of them were in color. What I said is I don't watch black and white movies because they're boring.
So, like,
North by Northwest is brilliant. The Birds is brilliant. Hitchcock's brilliant. But I just, there's something about old men talking like this, as
they do
about in the old
art
movies
created before relatively minor technological innovation.
There's something about art pre-1945 that's just like it's your grandpa's art. So
that is such an insane statement. I don't even know where to begin. Maybe listeners.
I need to get back to me watching Casablanca because I finally understand like every cultural reference of like that I've ever heard is from that movie.
You didn't just watch it; you watched it with Mark Tracy.
Yes,
right. What are the cultural references? So Play It Again, Sam is one.
Of all the gin joints.
Of all the gin joints and all the, this is like when you read the Bible and discover
Hasta
all
the Vista,
stuff
Baby, which, you know, Humphrey Bogart says to Ingrid Bergman, I'll be back when the Nazis.
And also, like, had I known it was like basically a Holocaust movie, I would have seen it much sooner.
Let's do some news of the Jews. How about that? Aerosmith announced their upcoming Israel show by having guitarist Joe Perry play a bluesy version of Hava Nagila on Facebook video, which Liel called the ultimate Jew face move from the ultimate dickwad. Your word Jew face, by the way, I was talking to our former guest, Rabbi Brent Chaim Spodek, and he was like, I need Liel's email because I have to tell him Jew face is exactly the coinage we need for that sort of shticky Jew face stuff.
I mean, the only thing that's like more offensive, culturally outdated, and just generally, you know, treacly is to play an actual Aerosmith song.
Right. While we're talking Jews and music and Jew face, the street performer known as El Maestro, who's in Mexico,
muy bien.
is entertaining tourists and locals in Mexico by singing traditional klezmer songs that he learned on the internet. What's funny about this is he's mad at Jewish klezmerers for not getting it right. Isn't that how the story goes?
Right,
this was culturally appropriating.
So it's basically, here's what the article
says. This was in the Wall Street Journal.
Musically, Mr. Perez is a strict traditionalist and disdains modern klezmer bands that fuse old world melodies with jazz, rock, and Latin music. So let's be clear. A Mexican street performer who has never, I don't think he's left Mexico. He just he feels very connected to klezmer. Doesn't like these bands of like young Jews in America basically being like funky klezmer. And he's like, that's not legit.
Can you believe these assholes?
But he's like, my favorite, and he wears a black hat, and like he wears the black and white. He has a beard. Look, he says he like is so well meaning about this. I can see how it might bother or offend someone, but I don't have any malicious intent. I used to have clothes in lots of different colors, but as they got worn out, I just got rid of them.
You know who else is a man in black? Every Orthodox moyle in Israel. But a new Knesset inquiry finds that 40% of all Israeli brisses are performed by unlicensed moyles. I didn't read far enough in this article to discover what the licensure process for a moyle.
It was deeply disturbing.
What's the test like?
But there has to, I mean, you can't just start doing it. How do you know what you're doing? There has to be a way to learn.
Which is actually a very fair question for moyles the world over. I mean, nothing Israeli moyle about this. Like, is there an apprenticeship?
I think in Israel, they need to do the same thing that they did to us on like week 3 of basic training, where they just like tie your eyes shut and then you have to take apart your M16 in like 35 seconds and put it back together again. I should be like, okay, Shlomo, listen. Here's a knife. Here's an 8-day-old.
Here's a baby.
Well, you know who's going to write to us about this is Dr. Bob the Moyle, who is one of our frequent correspondents at Unorthodox
at TabletMag.com.
Because he's going
to say, yes, there is a lot of things I had to do and like a certification board, because Moyles don't want people, like I don't think a Moyle would want anyone to think that they don't go through that rigorous training if they do.
Well, what do? They show, do you get a little sticker for your driver's license that says a little like scalpel on it? I mean, how do you, I've been to a lot of brisses. I've never seen them flash the ID.
I think it's like a word of mouth situation.
Name's Moyle, Bob the Moyle. It's a line from Casablanca.
For our last bit of news of the Jews, Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner have apparently chosen their shul in Greater Washington. We got a letter from our frequent correspondent, Tippi Pearl Turner, who said, as you know, I've been a fan of your podcast since day one. However, this week's podcast was less than stellar. She's talking about the podcast from 3 weeks ago. I was deeply upset by your diatribe against Jared and Ivanka's shul search and the implication that no shul would want them. Just to be clear, I did not vote for Trump, and I await his administration with more than a little trepidation. However, my feelings for Trump in no way would make me uncharitable toward his children. Doesn't the Torah teach us to welcome the strangers in our midst? In our shul, new families are welcomed with open arms, regardless of political beliefs or other apparent differences. I'm deeply disappointed that you would allow your vitriol to spill over and mar this basic Jewish premise. I'd hope any D.C. shul would welcome the Kushner-Trump family with open hearts and open minds. Sincerely, Tippi.
She's such a good person. Come on, Sippy. We were like,
we're just being a little catty,
messing around.
Nah. We were not.
But
doing
I agree on the premise. I think it's a little awkward for the other shul goers because, like, they represent a lot. They are like Trump surrogates, right? Like, it's a little awkward. I think it's unprecedented territory.
But I'm glad they're not building their own private little shul room in the West Wing. Like, I'm glad they're out there in the community. I hope they go.
You two are very soft. I have two things to say, if I may.
Can you do them in your accent?
The first, but what do you mean? The first is that they chose a Chabad shul, which I think makes the Kushners the first people ever to go and ask Chabad people, excuse me, are you Jewish? Are you? And the Chabad people are like, no, we're fine. We're good. Don't worry. God bless Chabad, seriously.
Love
the second
Chabad.
Thing is this. Tippi, look, you know all of us here love and respect you very much, but... And I do agree with your interpretation of the Torah, but at the same time, come on now. You know, my father drinks a fifth of vodka before
noon. Your father of blessed memory.
My father robbed 21 banks. But if my father came out there, so this is to say my father is no angel, but if my father came out there and said, you know what we should do? We should take everyone who believes in a certain religion and subject them to all kinds of extrajudicial measures. You know what I would do? I would say, fuck you, Dad. Because it's the responsibility of every sane,
it takes far less to get you to say "fuck you, Dad."
human being, and so as they enter the community, I think the community should actually should absolutely accept them as they should accept any Jew. You know, even say Peter Beinart. But as they accept them,
shots fired.
Let them never forget as they sit there in Mincha and Maariv. That they have made a very substantial moral decision, and let everyone with whom they come in contact remind them casually and less so of that fact, because they had a fucking responsibility. And especially Mr. Kushner is now an official envoy. These are not just bystanders.
Yeah. He's going to make peace
this
in the
is
Middle
not,
East.
This is not Tiffany.
It's not Chris
Trump,
Martin.
Right.
Right.
It's Jared Kushner. We can all unite in our hatred.
And so if you're down with that, if you're down with an administration that is cool with, you know, downplaying the actual credibility of our espionage and intelligence facilities in order to support shady business interests, cool.
But look, here's what's going to happen, right, is that Jared and Ivanka are going to go from time to time, and they're not going to talk politics there. They're just going to – they're going to rush to the front of the line to get the good sable at the Kiddush like everyone else. And if they don't talk politics to anyone –
I don't think they stay for Kiddush.
You don't think they stay for Kiddush?
They have four kids. Like, you know, you don't stay for Kiddush.
Do they bring the nanny with them to shul?
I think for sure. We bring the nanny with us to shul.
Well, I think they stay for Kiddush. And by the way, your shul is on my Facebook feed every Friday night because they're live streaming.
Well, it should be.
They're live streaming Shabbat services.
And Joe Perry's Hava Nagila.
Listen, we have to welcome some new subscribers to our newsletter. This week, we are welcoming the law firm of Yaakov Garfield, Leah Steinberg, Neil Fadden, Eli Savitsky, Sharon Litwin, David Lightman, Margaret Preston, Claire Dubin, Dana Schwartz, Daniel Hogan, and Nicole Knepler. Of all of those, I'm most interested in Neil Fadden. Who do we think Neil Fadden is?
Oh, I know who Neil Fadden is.
Who's Neil Fadden, Leah?
He's the former Neil McFadden. He had a bar named McFadden's on Second Avenue. Until one day.
I think I've been there.
He looked across the street and he saw a lovely young Stern graduate named Rivki, and they fell madly in love. And Rivki said, look, the one condition of our conscious coupling has to be for you to drop your awful name and convert. And so now he's Neil Fadden. Still owns the bar, though.
Is it called Fadden's now?
It's called Fadden's.
So there's a lot of whitefish.
And there's Slivovitz and whitefish.
So he's a barkeep on Second Avenue. He's an Irish barkeep on Second Avenue.
Well, Irish-Jewish.
Irish-Jewish, yes. Barkeep.
See, I feel like... I'm going to tell you what I think he is.
Who's Neil Fadden?
I think he was like, he wasn't an A-Pi, but he was like in ZBT. You know, like he was, and he wasn't that active, but he like was rush chair.
He was rush chair.
He wasn't active in like the other stuff, right. But he was an important, like he was the face of the community. And we're talking like, I don't want to say Michigan, but I want to say a school like with a big, like, you know,
Wisconsin.
A social seat.
Maryland? Was he at Maryland?
I'm just trying to think of where ZBT is. No. Yeah. But I don't know.
Rochester.
I actually think you guys are probably right, but my initial theory.
You think Liel's right?
One of the two of you is right. They're both better than my theory. I initially thought Neil Fadden was clearly the son of an English professor who always wanted to write the definitive Philip Roth biography, but could never get access to Roth or to Roth's papers. So to show as a token, his sort of last ditch attempt at getting access to Roth was to say, we're having a son, we're naming him Neil after Neil Klugman in Goodbye Columbus. And he sent Roth a letter with a little picture of little Neil. He said, this is my boy Neil after Neil Klugman.
Swede Lvov Alexander Portnoy Fadden.
Exactly. And it didn't work. Roth, of course, being reclusive and misanthropic, it didn't work. But Neil was stuck with the name. Hello, life. Upcoming live shows. Okay, listen up, because this is tonight. I have something tonight, Thursday, January 12th. I will be at Long Story Long, which is a storytelling event at Under St. Mark's Theater, 94 St. Mark's Place at 7 p.m. It's this really, really fun storytelling event where they only have three storytellers. So each of us gets a little breathing room. Long Story Long. I'll be telling a story about the time when I was 10 years old that a friend and I fell under the spell of a Ouija board. This is for realsies. Go to horsetrade.info or search for it on Facebook. Long Story Long, Under St. Mark's Theater, 94 St. Mark's Place, 7 p.m. tonight, Thursday. Come out and see me. I would absolutely be elated. And also my in-laws, the Fremers, are coming. So come meet my in-laws. Okay. Here's the biggie. We've been talking about the special secret special sauce show. It is January 25th in New York City. Unorthodox Takes Gotham. 2 weeks from now, January 25th, we will be at the Jewish Community Center of Manhattan. Our guest will be podcast legend Jonathan Goldstein, who is the host of CBC's Wiretap, and now he hosts the show Heavyweight on the Gimlet Network. One of the great all-time radio funny men legends. He's also on This American Life all the time. He will be our Jew of the Week. Our Gentile of the Week will be Ross Douthat. That's how you pronounce it. People always wonder. The New York Times op-ed columnist, token in-house conservative Ross Douthat. And then the Jubador will be fronting a three-piece band and more, so much more. To register, go to jccmanhattan.org/calendar. That is jccmanhattan.org/calendar. We also have info up on Tablet's Facebook page. If you're planning to come, email us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com and maybe you'll get a little shout out from the stage. So January 25th, JCC of Manhattan. And then, as you know, February 10th, we will be at Temple Israel in West Palm Beach, Florida. Shabbat Eve, we're part of their own egg that night. So get some sun, come on out, see us February 10th, Temple Israel, West Palm. If you'd like to book us for a live show, email Alyssa Goldstein at egoldstein@tabletmag.com and, you know, make her an offer. Thanks. Our Jew of the Week, I may call her the Jewess of the Week. How do you feel about the word Jewess?
As long as you call me.
That's the answer I'm looking for. Our Jew of the Week is comedian Lynn Harris. She's co-creator of the award-winning and cultishly followed Breakup Girl, about the superhero who saves the world by saving your love life. She's a journalist, a retired stand-up comic. Are you fully retired?
I'm mostly just tired.
You're just tired. She's a storyteller. She's an author of many funny books, including Death by Chick Lit. She's married to a rabbi, though that doesn't define her. She is founder of the new startup Gold, which is online at Gold Comedy for Girls, which is designed to give girls and women the tools to find their funny. Is that right?
Yes. Find their funny, give them places to share it with the world.
You have a long history of doing things that meld your entertainer side with social justice and activism. Why comedy? I mean, one could argue, like, well, that's not the way to change the world.
You could argue that, but that's not funny.
But then you'd be an asshole, right? I see.
I really think that comedy is power. And we just want to give that power to more people. And if more people had that power, and more different people, and more diverse and assorted people had that power, we'd all be better off. And we'd all, maybe even, the world would also be a little funnier.
Okay, that, I mean, that sounds good, but how, what do you mean comedy's power?
Okay, so one example. Let's say you're a stand-up, and one of the big most, the most important things about being a stand-up is really uncovering your authentic persona. And let's say you're a teenager. And let's say there is the thing that you're embarrassed about, or the or that kids bully you about, or that you think that you're afraid people will know about you, or the reason that people aren't your friend. That thing is actually you. That thing is actually what makes you funny. So instead of changing yourself to be funny, you double down on yourself to be funny. And that is just the most powerful thing you can possibly do.
So to me, thinking about being, having been a teen once, there's nothing more terrifying than getting on a stage, getting in front of anyone and doing anything. So what about that, like the stand-up process really like is liberating for young people?
Well, it depends on your perspective and what terrifies you. So for example, when you're on stage talking, you're also not talking to people.
Oh God, that individually. Sounds amazing actually.
So exactly. So, you know, that's what I tell people a lot, is that you're like, oh, I want to do that, but I'm too shy. And I'm like, perfect. When, don't change a thing. Get on stage and mumble, and that's your persona. And also, then you don't have to talk to anybody. And they're like, wait, what? That's, you know, to go back to your question, that's really the, at least the personal part of the power of comedy for sure.
So at the risk of sounding like a complete intolerable hipster, are we about to fuck this whole comedy thing up? Because, you know, I have the sense that, say, like 7 to 10 years ago, there was a sort of like amazing kind of explosion of amazing comedy, and it was really doing incredible things. But now we're at this sort of like heightened awareness of it, and all these comedians take a much shorter time, you know, kind of gestating from promise to stardom. Are we kind of jumping the shark for comedy?
No, I think we're good. I think we're good. I know what you're saying, but I think
we're
good.
Is this grunge rock circa 97 is what I'm asking?
No, I think we're good.
I have a different concern, mm-hmm. Which is, is there a fear, ought we be afraid that the sensitivities, the current sensitivities about racial language, about identity, the sort of resurgence of identity politics, where all of a sudden there are certain things that people in certain communities aren't allowed to say, like, you know, you're white, you can't make that joke. You're a woman, you can't make that joke. You're cisgendered, you can't make that joke. That could be lethal to comedy, can't it? Because a lot of comedy is having fun at other people's having your own expense, but also sometimes other people's expenses. And the gift that comedians give each other when they're in a room together is they understand we're all working the room, and it's out of love. It's not out of hate. Like, we're punching up, not punching down. But I feel like that's kind of threatened if, when comedy gets too balkanized into different, you know, into different identity groups. No?
Well, I think two things. I think one, actually, I think it's great, because I think that now comedians have less license to be lazy. You know, and honestly, I think the problem with jokes that kind of make fun of other people or whatever, punch down, you can have a separate conversation about why they're inappropriate for a bunch of societal reasons, but they're also like the lowest difficulty level of writing. So they're probably the least funny. So I think that if there's a challenge for comedians to be less lazy, and most comedians aren't, like, you know, I'm just saying in the abstract, if that's the challenge, then bring it on. I also think that there's a bit of, as much as I'm sitting here talking about how comedy is so important, and I believe it is, I think there's a little bit of a facile sort of a chestnut about how comedy changes people's minds. I'm not sure it does. I think one of the reasons we laugh at comedy is that it reinforces what we were already thinking. We just didn't think of it that way. I think what we have now is the opportunity to work harder, and we're going to have to, because Trump is not funny.
Trump is not funny.
He's not funny. Yeah. I mean, comedians are really just like,
well,
oh,
I was going to ask
Christ,
about, I was going to ask
funny.
About comedy.
Hold on. Before we do that. So, to get back to this question of boundaries, I assume this is something you grapple with yourself. Where does your boundary lay? For example, if you came up with like the world's greatest, funniest, most sparkling joke that happened to be a rape joke, is that something you would
question.
Tell on stage?
Well, I mean, there's rape jokes and there's rape jokes, right? And the thing is, it's the
I always say that.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I always say
three
it
three times.
rape is the topic. When you're talking about a rape joke, rape is the topic, but it's important to discern who's the target. So if the target is the victim, not funny. If the target is the culture, if the target is the, you know, the ridiculous way we blame the victim for, you know, having been, you know, in the wrong place at the wrong time, wearing the wrong shoes. Actually, you can absolutely write a fantastic rape joke that punches up, right? Reductress did a whole issue of that was solid 100% rape jokes, but they were like rape culture jokes, and it was side-splitting. It was really funny. So I would just say, I don't know, what's the rape joke?
Well, but doesn't that kind of demand that we break down the joke writing process into these sternly observed analytical processes? I mean, aren't
comedians
jokes...
do. Like, really good comedians know the rules so well, they don't think of them when they're following them, but they also do. Like, really good comedians, I mean, I know what you're getting at. You're getting at the idea, but if you break down the joke and analyze it into its tiny granular parts, it's not funny anymore. Which, yeah, but that's not, but the process actually
does work
that way.
Well, that's why comedians aren't fun to hang out with.
Right.
Because they're actually not that funny in person, because they're trying bits on you. Yeah, you're okay.
Oh, thanks.
But you're okay because you're a Jewess, and Jews are funnier, right?
Well, yeah, I mean...
Are we?
Yeah.
Or is it just like, it's a cabal and we own the industry?
Well, I mean, this is my second idea. My first idea was to get more Jews into comedy, but I just couldn't get any. And my pitch deck was just lame.
You couldn't
just
get the startup capital?
No. Yeah.
That's because the Jews control the banks.
I know. What am I not getting here?
Those Jews are not funny. Are we funny?
Yes.
Do you really think Donald Trump's not funny? Yeah. I mean, I don't mean as a comedian. I mean, as like a persona. Are you not a little bit amused by the fact that a third-rate reality TV celebrity now has his stubby little fingers on the nukes?
I mean,
nukes?
Once in a blue moon, I've heard there are some jokes that like that happen to hit sort of the way that like broken clocks are right twice a day. But like, I think at least I can report, and I can report that's not only my opinion, but every single late night writer and every single stand up I've talked to has been like, I got nothing. And to me, the only place where you can make jokes is not about him and not making light of the situation that we're now in, but rather making jokes about how we're traumatized by it, making jokes about our own experience of it. It's exactly like September 11th jokes, where I remember Marta Raven, Jewess, very funny. She had one of my favorite perfect tiny little 9/11 jokes right after 11 when we all freaked out. I was doing stand up then, and we were like, "What are we going to do?" And Marta had this great joke about how once we all kind of revived, a couple weeks later, she had this great joke about how she walks down the street and anytime she sees a brown person, she's so traumatized and feels so bad that anytime she sees a brown person on the street, she wants to say, "I don't think you did it." You know, and that's not a joke about the terrorists. That's a joke about us. That's a joke about our cult. You know, so that's a perfectly, not only acceptable joke, it's a hilarious joke. So I think there are jokes today that one could make about all sorts of, like, the ripples of what's happening, but not the what of what's happening.
To me, the fact that Donald Trump can't take a joke is so significant. Is that important? Like, Obama was always in on the joke, it seemed like.
I think there's something, I mean, I would actually
Well, he could
kind
laugh
of,
at himself. I mean, yeah, it says so much about his character that he could laugh at himself.
I would actually bat that question over to a psychologist.
To be fair, Obama could take the joke because all the jokes were written by sycophants who spent 8 years admiring him.
Yeah, the jokes were softballs because they're like, dad jeans. Because there wasn't much. Like, he's not that funny. I mean, there wasn't much to...
Well, you could have done a little bit better.
Probably.
In the file under how we got to President Trump, maybe... just maybe.
If had there only been better jokes.
Better with Obama. Been better jokes, right?
You know, just saying.
Right. So if people are interested in Gold, they could go to Gold Comedy for Girls.
Yes, I have free workshops. Free workshops. Teach how to do stand-up. Come in the morning, leave in the evening, have them perform stand-up for your
Can
parents
you really
and friends.
Teach that? Like, seriously, yeah. do you believe that?
Like, I don't believe it. It's a thing. That's like saying, can you really teach calculus? Do you believe that? Like,
well, but I actually
do you
believe
really
that
not
you
vaccinate your children,
look,
Lynn?
For example, I believe that you cannot teach writing. I think that you could get a really shitty writer to be a pretty mediocre writer. I don't think you could get a mediocre writer to be a good.
I don't imagine
great
you're saying
writer.
You can teach someone to be a great comic. There's a certain talent.
What
baseline.
I can do is they come in, the teenage girls come in the morning at 10 with nothing. We give them tools,
nothing
skills,
but their insecurities.
Nothing but game and their insecurities. We give them M&Ms and we give them pizza and we give them basic. We give them just basic stuff, basic info about this is the structure of a joke. We apply that to stuff about their lives. By the end of the day, we've sort of molded it into about a minute and a half of stand-up, which they then perform for their friends and family at the end of the day.
Before we let you go, tell us one thing about being a rabbi's wife.
Just one joke about That's being funny. A rabbi's wife.
I imagine this was a lot of your routine back
I used
in the day.
No, actually, no, it no? wasn't. It wasn't. But I did used to say that they were just so, when he was a pulpit rabbi at the time that I got married. Now he's the dean at HUC in New York. And but he was at a pulpit when we got married. And I used to say that they were like, so do they like you? Do they like you? What do they think of you? And I used to say, listen, they were just so happy that he got married that I could have starred in a porn about Rosh Chodesh and they still would have loved me.
What would that porn be called?
First of the month.
Now everything we say
Listeners,
is going to sound dirty.
Write to unorthodox@talentmag.com with the
Blue Tish Ray.
The title of the porn about Rosh Chodesh in which Lynn Harris will be starring. Lynn Harris, thank you for being our Jew of the Week.
Thank you.
Send in the clowns, those Daffy Laffy clowns. Send in those soulful and doleful schmotes by the bowlful clowns. Send in the clowns.
The mailbox. A lot of people thinking about Jewish identity in our mailbox. Our mailbox is like a sofa. It's like an analyst's couch on which you recline.
It's an analyst couch for us, too. I mean, the mailbox currently is a major source of comfort and joy for
me. It's amazing.
But also reflection.
Yeah. It's really amazing. Okay, we'll start here. Dear Unorthodox, growing up going to Sunday school and Hebrew school, I always felt like an outcast, and I struggled to make Jewish friends. I got to the point in college where I felt I had no real connection to my community. Paradoxically, though, when it came to a faith system and philosophy of looking at the world, strictly speaking, the Jewish religion made the most sense to me. So I continued, grudgingly, to practice Judaism. I married a practicing Southern Baptist, but I made sure that she understood I would continue practicing Judaism. We've been blessed with a healthy 4-year-old girl, but I've always had this humongous fear that she would never be accepted in the community because of her decidedly un-Jewish mother. And here enters your newsletter. Seeing your most recent newsletter with a celebration of Carrie Fisher, who had a decidedly un-Jewish mother as well, has renewed my faith in the community of my people. In fact, happening upon your podcast and Tablet Magazine has had the same effect. Thank you so much for existing and doing what you do. I seldom express to anyone my feelings of my faith and community, let alone strangers, but I really felt like I needed to reply to this one. Sincerely, Daniel Hogan.
Daniel Hogan, as we say in the yeshiva, bismillah, my friend.
All right. Hi, my dear and definitely fun staff at Unorthodox. I grew up in a culturally Catholic but basically atheist home. For some reason, I always felt some connection to the Jewish people. When traveling, people would address me in Hebrew, mistaking me for an Israeli. My Russian grandfather's surname was Geller, so people assumed he was Jewish, and I always enjoyed Jewish culture. Well, some 4 years ago, after doing research, I came to the conclusion that my grandfather's family was indeed Jewish, but had decided to pass as Russian Orthodox to escape the pogroms. And it dawned on me that my mother, who had passed away by then, had probably passed on to me, unconsciously, a Jewish identity. 3 years ago, I decided to be open about this and have happily incorporated Jewish rituals at home. My Gentile partner hasn't doubted or questioned my decision in the least. I can't be halakhically Jewish because it was my mom's father who was Jewish, not her mother. I can't convert to Judaism because I'm an atheist. The city where I live right now has a Jewish community so exclusive that it doesn't accept people like me as Jews. But if I were religious, I'd no doubt say I had a Jewish soul. So, Unorthodox, can I say that I'm Jewish? Tad. Well, Tad.
By the powers vested in us.
We hereby.
You had me until Tad.
So, one thing I would say is, if your grandfather was Jewish, according to the Reform movement, God bless them, you are Jewish because paternal descent is fine. And so, you know, your mother was and you are, and go with God.
According to the Lords of Podcast.
Yes, but more importantly, according to the powers vested by the Panoply Network and Tablet Magazine, hell yeah. Most Jews are sitting around wondering what, you know, if they should go to temple. Do they love Judaism? Do they not love Judaism? They're tearing their hair out. They're rending their garments. They're gnashing their teeth. And you just love Judaism? God bless you, mate. Come to you are a Jew.
Yep.
You are a Jew.
Welcome. There's
pretty much two questions on that test. Are you serious about this? And do you feel it in your heart? If the answer is yes, hey.
Is this the Moyle test?
Well, yeah. That's also the Moyle
Frickin'
test.
Frickin' Tad. All right. Three more quick letters. Hi, just wanted to let you know that you have clandestine frummies listening to your show. I was LOLing when you guys were discussing our fashion choices. This was when we were talking about fashion of the
about sweaters and
Orthodox
stripes.
Women.
Yeah.
Liel was wrong. Stripes aren't a thing anymore. That's so 2014 or even older. Only the Nebbie, slang for bad fashion taste, only the Nebbie women are still wearing those. Stephanie had it right when she said that there seemed to be trends.
I'm pretty Nebbie.
I don't know who decides these trends, but every season something new is in style. Mark, good eye. Pleather patches are going strong since 2015. Boom! Hasidic fashion is going through major changes right now, as evidenced by Instagram accounts like at Mimu Maxi, M-I-M-U Maxi, at Pashmina Collection, and others popping up. Check it out if you're curious about the fashion choices of the Housewives of Borough Park. Always love your show. Very funny and entertaining to listen to while I'm at work. Signed, anonymous, so that my husband won't find out. Oh.
Anonymous.
We also, by the way, got another letter from a covert Haredi listener, a 16-year-old boy. Did you guys see that letter in the mailbox?
Yeah, I love that.
For the 16-year-old boy's like, I love your show, but I'm in the Haredi world and, you know, I don't know.
I don't understand what you're talking about.
Right. Okay.
Stephanie, what's a Taylor Swift?
Stephanie, Drake?
Stephanie, Mark, and Liel, I found the discussion of Jewish celebration of Christmas very interesting. My former Protestant, now atheist, agnostic family is celebrating Hanukkah for the second year. We have no Jewish roots, but we are fascinated by the rich and beautiful story and tradition behind many Jewish holidays like Hanukkah. Coming together as a family each night to light the candles and say the prayers in Hebrew, eating homemade latkes and sufganiyot, and playing dreidel gives us a non-commercial sense of family and tradition that, frankly, we cannot find in Christmas. In fact, our tradition is to donate money to a different charity each night of Hanukkah instead of giving presents. As a lapsed Christian, I deeply envy the cohesiveness of the Jewish community. So I hope you might excuse our shameless cultural appropriation, as it comes with high admiration and the best of intentions. Your podcast makes a point to welcome people regardless of their views on God. I'm not sure that this sort of inclusiveness or celebration of healthy skepticism could ever be embraced in the Christian community. Thank you for making a safe and wonderful space for people to discuss life and belief or lack thereof without apology. Annette Tapper, Texas.
The El Maestro of Texas.
We are big among Texas Christians.
Only a Texas Christian could look at a Jewish community and be like, isn't it beautiful the way these people are cohesive and never argue? But Annette, welcome. We love you. And invite us over for Hanukkah next year, because we will come. We will cook latkes.
That's right.
We will sing Sevivon Sov Sov Sov.
We will take your charity.
We will take your charity money. Everything you want.
Dana in Chicago wrote in. She was binge listening old episodes. She wrote in to thank Liel for the hotter than hot Israeli accented hummus recipe.
Yes. Don't remind
that
me.
Dana, that is true.
Still haunts my dreams.
That's right.
Just kidding.
We had one listener who wrote in. She's trying to find out if the Australian actress Margot Robbie is possibly Jewish. I don't know Margot Robbie.
Margot Robbie.
But our listeners are going to check on that. Finally, hi, Stephanie, Mark, and Liel. I'm an American who's lived in Europe for about a decade, and no matter where I'm living, Jewish men have a way of finding me. I just want to say, I love this letter. A good 70% of the men I've dated in the past 2 years are Jews who've picked me out both in the real world and online. Now, when I meet a guy who seems into me, if he doesn't make it immediately apparent that he's not Jewish, I just assume he is. I myself am not Jewish. I don't live in Israel. I'm not on J-Date. I don't have any female Jewish friends who might be acting as vectors. I don't work next to a synagogue. So, I'm afraid this might somehow be a racist question.
Because that's where the Jews go, to the synagogue.
They hang out next door to the synagogue.
So, I'm afraid that this might somehow be a racist question, but what is going on? Are there certain qualities that Jewish men find especially wifeable, the way that Spanish men tend to obsess over blondies with blue eyes and withholding demeanors? I didn't know Spanish men were into withholding demeanors.
I don't think Spanish men know that either.
I guess I'm asking whether there's a universal-ish code, spoken or un, for what Jewish men like in a lady. Finally, I'd like to emphasize this is not a complaint. I'm happy with my Jewish paramours and find we have a lot to talk and laugh about. I'm just wondering what it might be that makes this shiksa catnip to tonight's Jewish boys. Thanks and wishing you all a decent 2017, Julia. Well, Julia.
That was your attempt at a pun, right?
Right. That was my attempt.
Is that a pseudonym?
The answer is that you're easy. And no, I'm just kidding. I don't know. What do we got for her?
I like that it's Berlin. Like, for some reason, because that's where Dan Savage had his whole thing.
Right. She did mention that she lives in
Berlin. Boyfriend thought he was Jewish, his German boyfriend. So maybe it's something that's happening in Germany.
Like, an Orthodox. Yeah. The fact that I am 6'2", blonde with blue eyes. And my name is.
But she's American.
Julia Oppersturmen Führergehagen. Does this have anything to do, is it?
If she were in America, I'd say the men are attracted to your interest in psychology, the fact that you're willing to like look at someone across from and break down their issues. But Europeans aren't into that at all.
Yeah, I think the fact that you're in Europe, it like there's
scrambles
a little
everything
more
for me.
diversity. I don't know, but maybe, I don't know. I don't know what it is, but I want to meet you.
Yeah, we need. Could you send Could you send us a picture? We're going to break it down.
This is
call it. Send us your phone number and your picture. We'll do this on a future episode. That's for all of you out there. Send us mail, picture and phone number optional, but write to us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com. It is a source of unending delight and pleasure for us throughout the week.
We don't have any other friends.
Our Gentile of the Week this week is he's a super Gentile. There's some Gentiles who are elevated to the realm of super, because you have two Gentile religions, actually. It's Robert Wright. Shira, our producer, put actually in your bio, born January 15th, 1957.
That's actually not true, but...
Is she close?
She's close. I probably put that on Facebook to mislead the people who would like to spy on me and steal my data, but, you know.
That's hilarious. He hosts The Right Show, which is on bloggingheads.tv, and The Meaning of Life TV, right?
That's right.
His Twitter handle is Robert Writer, and there's where you can get his musings. He's a journalist and a scholar. Here, I think of you as a science writer, but that kind of diminishes you, I think, because you're a meaning of life writer.
Yeah, I focus on the Gentile part myself. I just always think of myself as Gentile of the week.
Right. So Robert Wright was raised Southern. So in my mind, Southern Baptist. Were you in the South? Because Southern Baptists are everywhere.
Yes and no. My parents are both from West Texas, but my father joined the Army, so I lived a lot in Texas, okay, but around.
And you have a book coming out next summer called Why Buddhism is True.
In case you were wondering.
In case you were wondering. Which seems like a distinctly un-Buddhist thing. We liberal types love the idea of Buddhism, because they're like, oh, dude, it's like Unitarianism. It's all true. And you're actually going to tell us that only Buddhism's true?
No, well, there are things it does not exclude being true. It's possible that Buddhism is true, and yet other things in the world are true. Like the sun rises in the morning, and yet Buddhism is true, yes. So there are other, it doesn't exclude other philosophical and religious truths.
I got you. So, I mean, for me, it's been interesting because I remember before I ever met you reading, you write on things like infinity and the moral animal, and the evolution of God is one of your books. And the moral animal was certainly the one that I think I remember reading first. And I think of you as kind of a rationalist writer. And yet, you know, like David Brooks, you know, it's like one day you're going to end up Deepak Chopra. I mean, you've gotten into yourself and spirituality and, you know, mindfulness and, you know.
You know, my mother's maiden name is Brooks, so I could actually be Jewish without knowing it, first of all. And in which case, I am not the Gentile of the week. But let me emphasize, as far as Buddhism goes.
Yeah.
There is a rational core to the philosophy, and I'm not supporting like reincarnation and stuff. I try to make that clear in the book. But there's a whole philosophy associated with the practice of meditation that makes claims about the nature of reality, the nature of psychology. That's what I'm focusing on.
So what do you do? How'd you get into this? What sucked you in?
You know, Jubus. You know, what else?
Is there any other kind?
What else? I mean, I went to the Insight Meditation Society.
Which one is that? Which Jew is that? Is that Jack
Kornfield?
That's
three of them. Jack.
Okay.
Sharon Salzberg, Joseph Goldstein.
Yeah.
In Barre, Massachusetts. It's an important place. I mean, it really was a major entry point for the whole Vipassana meditation tradition, which is huge now. That's kind of what mindfulness is.
Right. So this was for an article. I'm guessing you went as a journalist. Someone was paying you to go.
No, actually, I went as a tortured soul. But you know, you try to get journalism out of everything, so you wind up writing a book.
Tell us about that. Why were you tortured? Were you in a lot of pain?
Oh, no, I wasn't. That's an exaggeration. But I think when you're brought up religiously and you lose your faith per se, you're inclined to be looking for things, I guess.
And so you go there, and what happens? What do you find?
Well, I'd never been able to meditate, and, you know, because I have the attention span of, like, you know, Donald Trump. And somebody suggested I try an actual 1 week meditation retreat. You go a week, you don't talk, you meditate like sitting meditation for 5.5 hours a day, walking meditation 5.5 hours a day. Not much to do, but meditate. And, you know, finally it clicked. I mean, dramatically, amazingly.
What was the moment like?
Well, there were a couple of moments. I mean, there was I actually described these in the book. One moment was, you know, I had had too much coffee, and I had this like over-caffeination feeling. I was like grinding my teeth, you know, and it's like you want to get away from it. And I'd been meditating for a few days, nothing had been working. All of a sudden, I was just like observing the feeling rather than, I mean, I was still feeling it, but it was no longer an unpleasant feeling. I had a kind of objective perspective on the feeling. And it turns out you can do that with anxiety in principle. I mean, it's not easy. You know, and you have to stick with the practice and so on. But that's a certain amount of the idea of mindfulness meditation is to get what you might call a more objective perspective on feelings that you're not wild about being enslaved by.
And so have you continued? Have you
I have a daily practice, yeah. And I've been to, you know, 5-6 retreats since then. This was 2003. I've done a total of a couple of months of silent meditation retreats.
Put together, not at
put together. You know, there are people who do several months.
Well, I was going
to
say
Mark Oppenheimer would not be able to do that.
Well, when I wrote my piece about Edo Shimano, the Buddhist Roshi who had, like so many Zen Roshis, a less than savory history with touching some of his.
I mentioned him in my book, by the way, having read your book.
And one of the things that I discovered when I talked to women who had been pulled into his orbit was that some of them got really addicted. They'd go to a retreat and they do a day and then they do a week and then they do a week, then they do a
addicted
month.
Addicted to not speaking?
Addicted to...
Like the silent... Are you talking about a silent
not
retreat?
Not to not seek... Not to, I mean, you can speak at some of them, but to life at the Zendo, at the retreat center of meditation. And when they'd return to real world and there'd be children and dishes and dogs to walk and, you know, garbage trucks outside, they couldn't handle it. Like that, the world they wanted was a world of meditation. And some of them would leave their families and some, I mean, because that was so much more pleasant than real world.
Yeah, there's a more moderate version of that, which is you get back from a retreat, you're in the zone, it's very easy to meditate, your practice is going great, then 6-9 months down the road, it's harder and harder, and you say, I need another retreat. So you go on a 1-week retreat like every 18 months or something, which is a reasonably non-pathological way to handle the addiction.
Well, I do transcendental meditation, and every 6 to 9 months, we go for a check-in for these precise.
You do TM?
Yes.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, you weren't there when we did our first New Haven show. I heard all about it on the way home. But you live in
no idea.
Two 20-minute sessions a day.
So I have a statement that leads into a question. So speaking of silent meditation, I mean,
I have a comment, and then do you have a comment, then a question?
I have a question that's really a comment. I'm at the 92nd Street Y.
Right.
So my dad proposed a silent, like a speaking fast on Yom Kippur, and he's sort of venturing into Jubu territory. So what is it with Jews and Buddhism? Like, how do you explain it as someone who has studied religion and who understands this more than your average guy?
Average
Southern
Baptist.
Why have Jews been so prominent in...
What is the attraction, do you think?
Well, it's a spirituality that doesn't require faith, at least if you adopt the kind of more secular version of it. So it's really open to people of any faith in principle. I mean, if you don't buy the reincarnation part and stuff like that.
I mean, if you look at like Maimonides, you know, the great, probably greatest theological contribution in the last God knows how many years, it's negative theology, right? It's like, can we say God exists? No, but we can say that he doesn't exist. Which, you know,
but that's not where Jack Kornfield and some of those other popularizers were coming from, I don't think.
Right, but
it wasn't from the reading of Maimonides.
I think that the theological underpinnings are there. But let me ask you a question. When you see the mushrooming of mindfulness, you know, how you know, asshole corporate entities come and be like, oh, we have a mindfulness practice here at, you know, Goldman Sachs that we do XYZ, you know, we have apps.
Hey, you're talking about potential buyers of my book. Careful, buddy.
You love those people.
They are great.
They are. Bob wants nothing more than to keynote a 10,000-person corporate convention where everyone gets a copy of his work.
I'm totally on board with their approach to mindfulness.
you're mindful of buying power.
Totally. Great. No, but I take your point, and on the one hand, a lot of people, I don't like to see it viewed as strictly self-help in the most selfish sense. At the same time, the idea behind the practice is that it starts out as therapy, but can draw you into more spiritual territory and toward a more kind of selfless approach to life. That can happen fairly naturally. So I certainly don't discourage people from trying it just to make their lives better.
So it's the beginning of the new year. Do you have any like tips? Like, I mean, not to ask you for mindfulness tips, but are there any things, like small things that you've implemented in your life that you think could just like really help other people?
Well, I mean, again, for me, the incremental approach didn't work. Just trying to meditate on my own and like trying to be mindful and stop and smell the roses. I had to do total immersion. I had to go do a 1-week retreat. And to some people, it comes more naturally. If it does, get a CD, you know, one of these things that leads you through the meditation and try it. But I do think daily practice is important. I mean, reminding yourself to stop and smell the roses is fine, but it's not like in Buddhist scripture. That's not, you know, that's actually not what it was. There's very little about living in the moment in the ancient Buddhist text. It's more about a more thoroughgoing discipline that then can be conducive to that kind of thing. But a tip for meditators who are trying to sustain the practice, just make sure that one time each day, at a minimum, you make contact with the cushion. It can be 3 seconds, but you know, if you say, I don't have time to meditate, just sit down, just do it literally, just sit down and get up, but at least you don't lose sight of the aspiration.
It's like putting on the running shoes is the hardest part.
Yeah.
Right, Liel?
No.
No?
No.
Is the running
Running
the
26.2 miles, that's the hardest one.
All right, so you have before you a panel of world-renowned Jewish experts, and we always allow our Gentiles of the Week the opportunity to ask us a question that they might not understand about our mysterious people. Do you have such a question for us?
I do have a question.
All right. What is it, Bob?
The question is, if you're born Jewish, can you choose not to be a Jew? And the reason I ask is because if you're born Christian, I found out it's remarkably easy to leave the tribe. If you say, I'm not sure Jesus is the Son of God, I'm not even sure God exists, a number of Christians are very happy to show you the door and not only allow you to not call yourself a Christian, but encourage you to not call yourself a Christian. And I'm guessing it's not quite so simple if you're Jewish.
Well, I think in terms of language, like the idea of a lapsed Christian is something we all sort of understand, but I've never heard someone be a lapsed Jew. Like, I mean, sort of colloquially, I think because you don't have that, oh, I decided, like, I don't believe in these certain tenets, and then therefore I'm no longer a Christian. I don't think it works the same way in Judaism.
See, this my liberal friend, is where we part ways.
But you're not liberal?
This may come as a surprise, but if you do not believe at all in your heart, forget practice, right, which is debatable and has always been. But in your heart, if you don't believe the fundamental tenets of this religion, and to me that very much includes the belief in God, I have trouble with calling yourself
but
a Jew. Theologically, I think you're out.
Theologically speaking, according to Jews and Judaism, you're never not a Jew if you're born a Jew.
Yeah, like halachically.
Theologically speaking, you can be excluded from community. You can be placed in harem. Right. They can ostracize you.
But if your mother's vagina was Jewish, that's
right.
It.
No, that's right. Theologically speaking, you know, it's the Hotel California. You can check out, but you can never leave. And so, for example, you know, you will, again, unless you're being ostracized, but even then, you're still a Jew. They can, you know, if you sort of make amends, if you grant your wife that divorce or you pay restitution to the people you cheated or whatever that the community was ostracizing you for, you're back in. You can be ostracized, but you're never not available to be counted in the minyan. You're never not available to be counted in the community that's needed to say prayers after
unless
to
you convert
to dinner. No, even if you convert, again, you're still halachically Jewish. We will get mail on this, but because over the years I've been asked this question and I've asked it, and the very strict rabbis I talk to will always no, you're still a Jew. You can be in bad favor. I mean, if you molest someone's kids, they won't let you in shul, but you're a Jew who molested someone's kids.
See, I think the loophole here, culturally at least, is Jews for Jesus, where most Jews would be like, not a Jew.
Well, so that's interesting, right? And what they mean by that is don't count them as they don't get. You don't get an aliyah in shul, for example. You don't get to go up and read from the Torah.
But they are calling themselves Jews, which is interesting.
And they are Jews, which is why when we had a Messianic Jew on the show, she was the Jew of the week, not the Gentile.
I was out that week.
All right. So if people want more Robert Wright, they should go to bloggingheads.tv, where they can also then hop to your meaning of life. You're the editor-in-chief of Blogging Heads TV,
right? I am.
And it's neat. It's you see two people side-by-side debating stuff. And actually, one of my favorite podcasts is the Glenn Lowry Show on Blogging Heads TV, which is just phenomenal, just week after week.
He's got a big following. Phenomenal. And it's all – everything is available as an audio podcast.
And everything's available as an audio podcast.
Pre-order the book. It's so nice to pre-order
Can
books.
We pre-order yet?
From your lips to God's ears.
Is it up?
Yeah, I think
it is up on Amazon.
So
yes.
You also want to read Why Buddhism is True by Robert Wright.
Buy it today. It will come as a nice surprise from the universe in August.
That's right.
And you would thank your good karma.
Follow him on Twitter at Robert Writer. And when you go to Wikipedia and see that he was born on 1/15/57, that's a lie. Don't send him a present that day.
No, send the present. It's not for my birthday.
Bob, thanks so much for being our Gentile of the Week.
Thank you.
Do we have any mazel tovs this week, Liel?
My mazel tov is to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who currently is undergoing his, I believe, 20th criminal investigation in 12 years.
A new record. It's not even a record in Israel.
And none of them found, none of them came to anything, which means that either he's really good at being investigated by the police, or the police is really bad at coming up with, you know, like evidence.
Stephanie?
Well, as the token young liberal here, a pop culture fiend, I'm going to throw a mazel tov to Meryl Streep, who used her. I see Liel. His eyes are
bugging.
Yeah.
I like Meryl Streep.
Who used her award at the Golden Globes to, you know, sort of speak truth to something. And very quickly got under Donald Trump's skin.
made the ultimate achievement.
Getting under Donald
Trump. Upsetting Donald
got
Trump.
An angry
the
tweet.
Rare feat of getting under Donald Trump's skin. My Molotov is also Golden Globe-based. I don't watch the Golden Globes on principle because they're not a real award show. But my Molotov is to Hugh Grant just for staying in the public eye. Just because the guy's made one good movie in his entire life. And here he is, you know, 30 years running. He's still a celebutant. And Mazel
Tov. The movie will be just out of curiosity.
Oh, I mean, Four Weddings and a Funeral was a
really
great movie.
Really? Because Love Actually is...
Not
that actually was a pretty great movie, too.
It was a pretty great
You
movie.
Loved Love Actually. Did you love Love Actually?
I love Love Actually.
Okay, so he made two good movies. Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine, on the web at tabletmag.com. Our show is edited by Noah Levinson and produced by Alyssa Goldstein and Shira Talushkin. Rabbinic supervision this week was, in fact, by Meryl Streep. Kosher Slaughtering is by Jeff Sessions. On Twitter, we're at tabletmag, but I am at markop1. Liel is at Liel. Stephanie is at Stuffism. And Stephanie is on InstaChat?
It's called Instagram.
Instagram, where she is S. Butnick.
I have to say I've gotten like 60 new followers since last week, since we announced my Instagram, and I feel like I really need to step up my game.
Listen, if you rate us on iTunes and send us an email saying that you rated us, we will send you a special gift in the mail. Our music is by Golem, but sometimes by the Jubador, Jim Nabel. We record in Argo Studios, or as it's known in Hebrew, Argo Studiot. We're proud to be part of Panoply Network. Shalom, friends.